Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Nicole Lorie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So Dr. Lorie, your office is charged with leading the nation in public health and emergency preparedness, response, and recovery. Before we delve into your priorities, what is national health security and how do we get there as a country?
Well, what I would say is that disasters take many forms and they affect all of us. We like to think that national health security is achieved when our country and all of our communities together are prepared to respond and recover from the health impacts of emergencies. To do this, you need strong, modern, nimble health and emergency response systems. You also need to have resilient people. And so that means, ideally, that you have people who are healthy. Prevention becomes very important. You can't have people who are worried about their health every day or health insecure. So on the one hand, we focus and very much support the prevention and health promotion missions of our department to help our country be better and stronger. And on the other hand, we really want to focus on building resilience so that people can recover from health emergencies faster.
So I'd like to explore your strategic vision and what frames your direction of your office. Would you highlight your key strategic priorities? And what are some of the key cross-cutting themes that inform your strategic approach?
The key themes and our overarching goals are, number one, having communities and individuals that are really able to withstand adversity. Having modernized systems with the capabilities that are not just on the shelf, but exercised and continually improving. So whether it is the healthcare system being able to move people to what I would call the next lowest level of safe and appropriate care, or a system that can rapidly vaccinate a population or get pills in mouth quickly, a modernized system with those capabilities that we exercise and know we can do if we have to. Making sure that we have the right policies at the national level to allow resilience to grow and develop and spread across the country, and that those policies are jointly developed by those they affect, really all of us. And then building our organization. As I said, our organization is relatively new. It doesn't have the long and impressive history that so many do. And so really building this organization, not quite, but almost from the ground up in terms of developing a staff and a team and leadership team, developing our people for the next generation of leadership, creating a culture and processes and procedures for doing things.
You've mentioned a couple of times the promotion of a resilient community or a resilient population. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the vigilance of resilience in a sense. How do you folks do that? What are some of the initiatives you have in place to do that?
Well, we've done that in a lot of really interesting ways. I should preface this by saying that most people judge how bad a disaster is by how quickly they can bounce back, right? And so this concept of resilience and being able to bounce back quickly turns out to be really, really important. But we've taken on some very specific initiatives to deal with resilience and to be sure that it's a driver of the health security programs across government. One that you'll probably be most interested in is one that we've been doing with social media. So we know that people who are connected with one another, who have strong social support, who are friends and relatives, they can count on an emergency, live longer, are healthier, and are more resilient. So one question we had was, well, how could we go about doing this? Well, what is it that most people use day to day? They use social media. And so we said, wouldn't it be a great idea if we could get a Facebook app, for example, where people could identify their lifelines? Turns out Facebook doesn't write apps, doesn't develop apps. Other people do on a Facebook platform. And so we were actually the first part of the department to use the America Competes Act, the ability to have challenges and competitions. And we put out a national competition for people to develop a lifeline app. And we got all kinds of really interesting submissions and ultimately awarded two contestants for this with lifeline apps. And They're working on launching those. And the goal, quite honestly, wasn't that those be the end-all and the be-all of Facebook apps, but that we start to try to stimulate the market in a variety of different ways so that at the end of the day, however it is that it happens, people get lifelines and that that idea catches on and that you have friends or family or people you can really count on when the chips are down. So that's one way. A second way that we've been doing this in a very a much narrower but very much fragile population are people who are dependent on various medical technologies to stay alive. And usually those medical technologies involve electricity or oxygen or something. And so we've started now a health resilience technology program to look at what are the kinds of technologies that would help people be able to stay at home when the power's out and the chips are down in that way, or help them get ancillary power. So we're in the process now of working through the development of signaling devices so that there are a medical equipment will signal either friends or an operation center or both when they don't have much battery life left and somebody can come get them a charge or get them batteries and that they can stay at home. So that's another way. One is through social media. One is through technologies. We work a lot on making the healthcare system resilient. So we just saw, for example, in Hurricane Sandy, what happened when nursing homes and hospitals lost power and had to evacuate. Well, what you really want is a system in a community that if one part of it is sick or injured, then another piece of it can pick up the slack. And so we've been supporting the development of what we call healthcare coalitions. So coalitions of all of the different kinds of healthcare entities to work together to support the community through an emergency. So that's another kind of resilience. And additionally, all of the part of our organization that builds the countermeasures, it's called BARDA, or the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, works on having the countermeasures we need so that we can be resilient in the sense of where there are biological attack or release, we would be able to protect our population because we would have the countermeasures and the medications, and we would be able to get pills in mouth, shots in arms, whatever it takes, in a very short amount of time. And so we spend a lot of time and energy on all of those components.
That's a very interesting strategy for promoting resilience. What about strengthening the federal health, public health and medical preparedness response and recovery capability within the country? And how does a whole community approach factor into your efforts in this area?
I think we recognize that no matter what we do, preparedness and response rests on a bedrock of a strong healthcare system and a strong public health system. That's why I am so concerned with all of the cuts to state and local public health around the country. Because you need a strong public health system to have a strong country. All disasters are local. And so local response and state response is always going to come first. And people rely first on their families and communities, and then on their state government, and then on the federal government to get this done in a series of interlocking pieces. So the first response is not necessarily the federal response, it's the local response. And we have to be sure that from a federal level, all of our programs and policies are aligned first to build that first line of defense, which is a strong local and state response. We also recognize that states and locals can't plan for or deal with everything, that some events are just too large or it's too inefficient. And that's really where the federal government comes in strengthening our federal response systems. That's where the National Disaster Medical System, for example, fits in. A preparedness system or preparedness and response and recovery are not only the purview of government. They are the purview of everybody. So individuals and families have responsibilities to be prepared and help each other out. Private sector entities, whether for-profit or not-for-profit, have responsibilities to lend their help and their resources in disaster situations, and they do. And it's really being sure that everybody can come together, that everybody has a part, they know what part they play, and that you can conduct that orchestra, as it will, you know, in an event That's the most important. But everybody has a role.
We've talked about a little bit about building resilient communities. We've talked about the importance of having a system that is strong and as well resilient. I'd like to talk a little bit about effective countermeasures. What are you doing in that area? And what does it mean to say we have a medical countermeasure enterprise?
So medical countermeasures are drugs, vaccines, devices that protect people from different kinds of health threats. The ones we think most about are vaccines, for example, that might protect you from a pandemic influenza, or other kinds of pharmaceuticals that might prevent you in the case of a biological release or a new infectious disease. At some point, it doesn't matter if it's Mother Nature that causes this, as in a bad influenza pandemic, or if it's caused by bad guys. We have to deal with the end result, which is potentially an epidemic or a pandemic that would be fatal that could affect large parts of the population. So many of the kinds of things that we need to protect our people are not for diseases that commonly occur. And so the traditional pharmaceutical enterprise isn't so interested or hadn't been so interested in working on those things because there's not a big commercial market and because they're only used in the case of an emergency. So the Public Health Emergency Medical Countermeasure Enterprise, or FEMCE as it's known, really brings together the different parts of government that are involved in the scientific development at the basic end, at the advanced end, the deployment of those measures to get to the point that we have countermeasures that are safe, effective, easy to use, easy to deploy, acceptable to the population, meet the needs of the population when you have them. And we are all in a partnership together. It involves many parts of HHS, DHS, the VA, DOD, the Department of Agriculture. We all are in a partnership together that now works very effectively to identify the countermeasures we need, to develop them, and when appropriate, stockpile them. We practice how to use them. And we're in partnerships, in public-private partnerships all across the country with industry partners who really do a lot of the advanced development and make these countermeasures for us that we ultimately stockpile.
So how do you make a system that is so complex, nimble, and responsive to the many and diverse threats that you have to face?
I think we've had a really big shift in thinking. And I think we've really moved, shifting philosophically away from one bug, one drug, to the kinds of products that work on the underlying ways that people get sick. We call them host mechanisms of disease or whatever. I mean, you know, for example, that viruses attack cells in different ways. Rather than having a drug that would kill a virus, we would have a drug that would protect the cell or keep the virus from killing the cell, just in simple words. The other thing that we've learned from this whole countermeasure enterprise per se is that it has lots of spillover benefits for day-to-day use. So I'll give you an example. One of the things that we've worried about has been the nation's supply of ventilators. We worry both about the supply and we worry about getting them quickly to people who can use them and use them at a mass scale, which means they have to be smaller, they have to have a long battery life, they have to be easy to use, and they hopefully have to be more usable by people with fewer skills. So we've set out to develop the next generation of ventilators. In doing so, the whole field, the whole market has started to change and improve, number one. The price of ventilators has come down pretty dramatically, so people are seeing a day-to-day benefit. But we're also very close now to having pretty revolutionary technologies that will help us in a big public health emergency, but also probably help us day-to-day in the back of an ambulance or for people who live on ventilators at home or other kinds of things. So it's actually very exciting to see this nexus between public health emergency use, you know, in a disaster, and day-to-day use, and understand that the investment that we make in preparedness has all of these day-to-day benefits.
And it's pushing innovation, too.
It very much is pushing innovation, and We are all about innovation in ESPR. We actually have an innovation team and an innovation fellow now working with us on the health resilience technologies.
How are we strengthening public health and federal medical preparedness, response, and recovery capabilities? We will ask Dr. Nicole Laurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.